Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
8.9 on the Richter scale, number 3 on the list of the world's biggest GDPs. The economic impact of today's earthquake on the broadcast from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 11th of March. Good to have you with us. Between the aftershocks that have been hitting Japan all day and the tsunami that's been working its way down the coast of North and South America, we still don't know exactly what the final toll is going to be once all said and done. What we can say is that the biggest city in one of the world's biggest economies has been basically brought to a standstill. We've reached Kenneth Kukie. He's the Japan correspondent for The Economist magazine in Tokyo. Kenneth, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, describe what it's been like for you there today. I imagine long day and a long night.
A long day and a long night. At 2:45, I was working. At 2:46, I was looking up, realizing that the building I was in was shaking to its very foundations, and I was looking for an escape route. We're used to earthquakes and tremors in Tokyo. It's part of everyday life, but not of this magnitude at all. The problem in this instance is you realize that the whole playbook of what to do in a circumstance like this doesn't work. All of the things that you're supposed to do start to look really silly when you realize that getting under a table doesn't help you if the entire building collapses. Going outside doesn't help you if things outside fall on top of you. Nevertheless, it comes in waves, and you take your luck like I did. And during an intermission, I made my way at a brisk pace to an environment where I knew I'd be safe.
Frame this earthquake for me in the economic context. Would you? Japan has been hit as hard as anybody by the recession. It's got enormous debt loads and now faces enormous restructuring and rebuilding costs.
That's exactly right. Economically, there's two problems. The first one is that certain factories have had to close. Nissan in particular, suppliers to Toyota, chemicals company, for example, has had to suspend its operations. That might have jitters around the world. It might even create ripple effects if these are vital goods. We don't know yet what they're making. The second problem will be for the debt. Japan doesn't have a lot of money to spend because they're so indebted, but they will have to. Now, in the short term, this will be good. The economy will, of course, have to pick up if you're pouring billions of dollars into infrastructure spending. But in the long term, this is a negative because Japan will have to pay that back someday.
Do I have it right that most of the Japanese debt is held by the Japanese people?
That's absolutely right. 95% of their debt is owned domestically. That helps you considerably politically if you want to fiddle with the economy to pay back the debt in different ways. You can inflate it, you can tax people, you can monetize it, securitize it, which you can't do if it's foreign-owned. However, it still has to get paid back.
Talk to me, though, about Monday morning and the weeks and months to come when things like airlines and insurance companies and car manufacturers realize the impact that this quake has had on production process and their ability to operate.
The good news is that it happens on a Friday afternoon. So you have 2 days where the stock market's not open, where employees are not going to work, and the government can get its act together. And on Monday, I think you will see a nation transformed. Japan does crises really well. They all snap to order, click in the same direction, march straight ahead. Rivals become friends in situations like this, or certainly partners, and they collaborate. They help each other. Logistics firms that don't work together will work together. Pharmaceutical companies, hospitals. You mentioned insurance companies. Yes, insurance companies will have to pay a lot. There are policies, but it's not as bad as you think.
Kenneth Kukie, he's the Economist Magazine's bureau chief in Tokyo. Kenneth, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Even before the shaking started, millions of people in Tokyo knew this quake was coming. Japan has spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 15 years building an earthquake early warning system. Today, that investment may have paid off, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
More than a minute before the ground began to shake in Tokyo, texted warnings hit millions of cell phones. Stations interrupted their broadcasts, bullet trains came to a halt, and factories got urgent emails to secure their assembly lines. It was Japan's earthquake early warning system.
I am certain that the system saved lives today.
Dr. Peggy Helwig is a seismologist at UC Berkeley. She says you can't predict quakes, but you can warn people that one's coming.
There are different kinds of waves that are radiated from an earthquake. The P waves are primary. They come first, and they travel faster than the S waves.
but S waves do the damage. So Japan's deployed thousands of sensors that detect fast-moving P waves. When those sensors feel a quake, computers calculate its size, then broadcast warnings across the country. Today, that entire process took 8.6 seconds.
The Japanese have been ahead of the game.
David Oppenheimer's at the U.S. Geological Survey.
After the Kobe earthquake, they spent somewhere on the order of $500 million to install modern seismic equipment in their country.
Those investments started in 1995, and the system went live in 2007. Today, the U.S. is developing a similar early warning system for the West Coast. Oppenheimer says it's at least 5 years and tens of millions of dollars away. From Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
World markets dropped after the quake. Wall Street managed to bounce back a bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Amazon's just about done with the state of Illinois. Yeah, you can still buy stuff from the online retailer if you live there. But if you make your living as one of Amazon's Illinois-based associates, you're out of luck. Amazon's cutting ties with websites in that state that have been selling Amazon's goods by way of advertising links. The company says it would rather do without the ads than be forced to collect sales tax under a newly signed Illinois law. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, sorts it out.
It's not just Amazon that's resisting growing pressure from budget-strapped states to collect sales taxes. Jonathan Johnson heads Utah-based Overstock.com. He argues the U.S. Supreme Court has already let companies with no physical presence in a state off the hook.
Overstock doesn't have any employees, any warehouses, any goods in Illinois. That's why we don't have to collect sales tax.
Johnson says Overstock just notified its Illinois-based affiliates that sell or promote its goods on their websites that those relationships are being terminated. The reason, the state contends, they make Overstock liable for collecting taxes. Rebecca Madigan represents the affiliates who get paid sales commissions in what's known as performance marketing. She says Amazon and Overstock don't want to be burdened with collecting taxes.
It becomes much more expensive for them than any sort of revenue that they're getting from these affiliate websites.
Jason Brewer represents brick-and-mortar members of a trade group that includes Walmart and Best Buy. He says their online sites collect sales taxes in all states, and their rivals aren't being honest about their unfair advantage.
Clearly, at this stage, they've built a business model around not collecting that sales tax, so I think it's rather disingenuous of them to suggest that it doesn't matter.
Chicago-based movie critic Roger Ebert is one of those who supports his website with Amazon sales links. Last night, he tweeted that he also supports the new law, but because Amazon has decided to evade what he called fair and just Illinois taxes, he has only 20 more days to make a fortune. Then he sent another tweet linking to an Amazon sale for Levi's. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Five days worth of economic news in 4 minutes is no easy trick, but the whole show's only half an hour, you know. So here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Great to be with you, Kai.
This is a question maybe for another time, but let me just ask you briefly, Lee, about the earthquake in Japan. And we talked up at the top of the show about what's going to happen there economically as a result. Draw back for a minute and talk to me about the global economic recovery. It is the number three economy in the world, after all.
It is. And actually, we saw an effect in the treasury market almost immediately with Japanese investors selling U.S. treasuries to, you know, repatriate money just to deal with the impact of the earthquake. You know, there's no doubt it's going to have an impact. I mean, the Japanese economy has been struggling for a while now. I think the impact is going to be bigger there than here, but we will see some impact.
Sudeep, at his press conference today, the president obviously talked about Japan, talked about oil and energy a lot, too. This was supposed to be a big day in Saudi Arabia, day of rage. It turns out not to have been so much. Oil prices have fallen, partly as a result of anticipated slowdown from Japan. Has maybe that little bubble we were seeing started to go away as people start thinking about other things than Libya?
We can hope that it has, but if you look across the Middle East, there's still a lot of attention there, and you're going to see this problem continue just because of global demand, if not for the turmoil in the Middle East. And even though the U.S. economy is less sensitive to energy than it once was, gas prices are still the most visible price in our economy, and that's going to hold consumers back and hold consumer spending back into the summer. And right now, it really looks like the payroll tax cut that started in January is being eaten up almost entirely by higher fuel prices.
Yeah, I mean, the president said that this morning. And so, Lee, what are companies thinking? Airlines and transportation companies? I mean, we're going to see fuel surcharges coming back, all of that stuff.
We are. I mean, it might be a little premature for that because, you know, oil prices still haven't hit that, you know, $120 mark when people really, really start to freak out.
Yeah, but it's never too soon for a surcharge, man. Come on.
That's true. But I do think most of the press, anyway, has been around the impact with the consumer and at the pump. I still feel like it's a little overblown. I agree with Sudeep. The long-term trend is definitely up, but this is not a huge oil shock
All right,
yet.
But yeah, but hold on a second. I mean, I'm paying $4.20 a gallon, and granted I'm in California, but even if you're in Iowa and paying $3.80 now instead of $3.15 2 months ago, that's money out of your pocket, Sudeep, right?
That exactly is. And in addition to being money out of your pocket, it just really holds people back psychologically. When you're thinking the economy is recovering, maybe it's time to go and spend more, you're seeing this big hole being burned in your pocket.
Sudeep, last thing this week, and we'll go out on the budget fight in Washington. The president now is being criticized for not having done more, for having been a little bit hands-off and having not really said, listen, this is what has to happen. Let's meet halfway. Looking at another government shutdown next week, where are we going?
Well, we really don't know yet how much his administration is working behind the scenes to come up with
True.
A bigger package.
True.
And most of what we're watching right now is still the posturing and the point scoring, since we're not talking about the big programs and the big money yet. And the political environment, even as bad as it is, could actually be a lot more toxic. We're actually inching away from the idea of a government shutdown with some of these shorter term bills and away from the idea of a failure to raise the debt ceiling.
Lee, very quickly, what's your sense?
I agree with Sudeep, but I think that no matter how many short-term solutions we have, what we have to do is cut from the big four, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense. You know, you're not going to get very far by making these little cuts, which is what we have been doing. I mean, kind of reminds me of when, this is a little bit of a tenuous analogy, but bear with me, when a writer files a story and it's twice as long and you start cutting out the that's and the it's, and what you really have to do is just take a huge swath of the center of the piece, and we're not doing that yet. And it's going to be very hard to do that on deadline. You know, we may have some near-term solutions, but I don't think we're out of the woods for the long-term picture yet.
Journalism and the federal budget. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
Money is power for women, and money changes the dynamic in the family.
The business dynamic for women in Afghanistan. But first, let's do the numbers. The earthquake didn't really rattle U.S. investors. The Dow Industrials gained 59 points today, about 0.5%, closed at 12,044. The NASDAQ added 14 points, also 0.5%, finished at 2715. The S&P 500 rose 9 points, 0.7%. Ended things at 1304. For the week, which saw some volatile trading due to oil swings and Libyan unrest, the Dow ended down 1%. The NASDAQ slid 2.5%. The S&P 500 declined about 1.3% or so. The Japan quake spurred companies that may be involved in the country's reconstruction. Shares of equipment maker Caterpillar plowed ahead 1.75%. Aluminum giant Alcoa strengthened by about 1.5%. Higher February retail sales boosted retail stocks, and tailor stores had good news, strong quarterly sales, and a bullish outlook. Women's clothing chain set up a 12.7% gain today. The earthquake did batter Tokyo shares. The Nikkei index dropped 1.7%. Right, it hit right before the close. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Municipal officials from across the country are gathered in Washington for the National League of Cities Congressional City Conference. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is scheduled to be in Paris for 2 days to participate in G8 meetings and meet with foreign government counterparts. And he won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Albert Einstein was born on March 14, 1879. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the basic ideas behind the health care reform law was to cut costs. One of the basic ways to do that, it turns out, is to coordinate patient care. Make sure that everybody a patient goes to see knows what everybody else that patient goes to see is doing. The reform law is trying to do that by bringing doctors and hospitals and insurance companies that handle Medicare patients into what are called accountable care organizations. Details of exactly how that's going to happen are still being worked out. We're expecting early rules sometime soon. But Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports from the health desk that just about everybody in the business of healthcare has something at stake.
Think of healthcare for a minute like buying a car, says Harold Miller. He heads a healthcare think tank.
Would you go to the engine store and buy an engine and buy a transmission and then somehow figure yourself out how to put those things all together and actually have a car that would genuinely be safe to drive down the road at 60 miles an hour?
No. But Miller says that's exactly how our current healthcare system works. I caught up with him recently at an American Medical Association conference. He says we buy the parts of our care and stitch them together. We shop around for specialists who may or may not talk with our primary care doctors. We decide among surgical centers and hospitals for outpatient procedures. Miller says healthcare would work a lot better, especially for people with chronic conditions, if patients had a team of providers and hospitals who shared responsibility for their care. That's the idea behind an accountable care organization, or ACO. Karen Ignani is CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans, the main trade group for health insurers in Washington.
That's the promise of what ACOs are supposed to achieve, a more integrated, higher quality performance and thus lower costs.
Integrated as in you see your primary care doctor, say, about your high blood pressure. She confers with a specialist who is a member of the ACO. You're given medication. An ACO nurse reminds you to take it. Everybody's in touch with everybody. There's no expensive duplication of tests or conflicting treatments. You stay well. The accountable care organization keeps costs down and is rewarded with a bonus. Sounds simple, but it's not. Again, Karen Ignani.
We are focusing in like a laser on the concern that this not be a recipe for more consolidation, higher costs, and more cost shifting.
Insurers are worried that doctors and hospitals in ACOs will get so big they can dictate prices and squeeze insurance companies. They want the new regulations to prevent that. Doctors and hospitals are also worried about their financial interests. They want only basic standards for quality, so it's easy for them to earn bonuses. And they don't want to be held accountable for medical services a patient gets outside of the ACO.
It's called accountable care organization for a reason.
Barack Richmond is a health economist at Duke University. He says rewarding healthcare providers when they meet goals and penalizing them when they don't is the only way ACOs can do what they're supposed to do, improve care and save money.
If the rules are written in such a way that doctors are protected from the downside, then I'm very skeptical that we're going to see the kind of foundational change to the delivery system that we really need.
And keep in mind, the new rules are preliminary. After they're published, there'll be a public comment period for recommendations for tweaks in the final rules. And everybody will have something to say. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates met with his NATO colleagues on Afghanistan today. There's too much talk about leaving Afghanistan, Gates said. Not enough talk about getting the job done right. Part of getting the job done right will be helping the Afghan economy. As foreign troops pull out, economic development teams are on the ground. Aid programs are in place as well. Aid that is increasingly being directed at women. It's not a huge amount. Less than 2 cents of every dollar goes to women. A couple of years ago, though, it was more like a half a cent on the dollar. That was going to female entrepreneurs who are creating jobs and helping to build companies.
Gail Samak-Lemon profiles some of those women in a new book called The Dressmaker of Carcana. Gail, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to me for a second about, in bald capital terms, the return on investment from investing in female entrepreneurs. I mean, everybody from Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times to Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury and White House economic guy, say, listen, you want to build a society, you want to fix things, you want to make changes, invest in the women.
Absolutely. And, you know, Kamal Siddiqui, the protagonist of this book, says it brilliantly, you know, which is money is power for women and money changes the dynamic in the family. A lot of times you have men in Afghanistan who are supporting 12, 13, 14, 15 family members on one income, which could be as little as $150 or $200 a month if you're fortunate. So you can imagine that by the time that they get a daughter or a sister or a wife who has the ability to bring money into the household, that changes the dynamic within the family and the respect that they get, the way that they're able to, you know, integrate girls and boys when it comes to education. That then promotes stability within the family and that promotes stability within the community.
And then that plays out through society writ large.
Absolutely. And I think that's what you see over and over again is I think people are often very quick to dismiss women entrepreneurs in Afghanistan as, oh, you know, they don't exist or this is a country where women are locked up inside. And the truth is women have been getting families through very difficult times in that country for as long as history's been written and certainly during the last 30 years of conflict.
Obviously, women of all ages and walks of life are starting business in Afghanistan. But I was struck by the story of one especially young woman. I mean, she's 23 years old. Her name is Shala Akbari. She started a shoe label. How did she do that?
Well, this is a great story about the multiplier effect. What happened was her mother was an entrepreneur who was working in a furniture business, and she saw the example of her mother. And I think from that example, she thought, well, why couldn't I do it too?
And she actually had a little bit of chutzpah too. I love her label, right? It's Made in Afghanistan.
When you are in Afghanistan, you'll see that so much is imported, right, from China, from Pakistan, from Iran. There's great leather domestically within Afghanistan. There's great fruits and vegetables, but it's much more expensive to produce for the local market than to import. And so you see a lot of people say, okay, why can't we make this a marketing advantage and actually promote homemade goods, promote things that are coming from, you know, the Afghan market?
Do they use local capital, too? Where do women like Shala Akbari get their seed money?
And this is one of the biggest issues. I think when you talk about women's entrepreneurship anywhere in the world, but particularly in difficult countries, access to capital is daunting because there's a lot of microfinance available and everybody's pretty quick to put women in the microfinance bucket. But if you talk about larger dollars that you need, it's pretty tough. So what you find a lot is people who just start small and then reinvest profits. Some people who will also get grant money to start, you know, there's a lot, you know, billions of dollars worth of aid money coming into Afghanistan. Precious little of it actually goes to small business, but that which does is often used as seed capital.
Does this trend of female entrepreneurs, successful female entrepreneurs, keep going when and if Western forces leave Afghanistan?
You know, these women want peace desperately. The fear is that the world will withdraw before its security forces, before its governance structures can catch up. And I think what women want now is a seat at the table in any kind of settlement or negotiation with the Taliban, because I think businesswomen in particular fear that their ability to contribute to their families will go away the moment that the Taliban return.
Gail Samak-Lemon from the Council of Foreign Relations. Her new book is called The Dressmaker of Carcana. Gail, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, a break from the news of the week and a chance to check out what didn't quite make the headlines. It comes to us, as it always does, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Jennifer Collins, reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Facebook is coming out with these new tools to combat bullying online.
Like combs and culture magazines to make people cooler?
Well, not quite. They've apparently created tools to allow victims to socially shame bullies.
Gee, I wonder why Mark Zuckerberg would be so interested in stopping bullies.
Seriously, Zuckerberg is like the living example of the nerd's final revenge.
Rada Beed, senior producer, Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, it's a brand new college degree at Columbia College in Chicago. You can now major in YouTube.
What? Is it like how to make money on YouTube?
It's how to make more professional content for YouTube. So your version of your Lady Gaga song will look much better now.
Right, but only after you take Kittens 101 and Introduction to Exploiting Your Cute Child.
Exactly, that's it.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Phil Collins is going to stop making music. It's very sad.
You know, I could see that coming in the air tonight.
Right. He says that he wants to spend more time with his two kids.
And he won't give us one more night.
No, not one more album. But, you know, the thing that keeps running through my head is how can he just walk away from us when all we can do is watch him leave?
Well, if he stays at home, no jackets required.
I don't know. I think it's just a shame, and that's all.
Too much time on their hands. That's what that one was. That is the merest hint of what Rico and Brendan have to offer. There's more on the podcast they do. It's called the Dinner Party Download, and you can find a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace for Friday. It's from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 59 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ added 14 points, also a half percent. The S&P 500 rose 9.7%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, beware retirement advice that comes for free.
Sometimes when they're supposed to be giving you just general advice, they may be guiding you towards their mutual fund.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.